to have you all here. All right, I guess we'll just go to it. Case number 1, 13-1232, 13-1278, Greedy versus F.C. Stone. And good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Stephen Bedell, a Foley and Lardner on behalf of the appellant F.C. Stone, LLC. Your Honors, we have urged four grounds of reversible error here, all of which bear the same hallmark, which is that in each instance, the district court substituted its own subjective sense of equity for what the plain language of controlling statutes and court orders required here. First, the district court allowed the clawback of both a pre-petition distribution of $1.1 million and a post-petition distribution of $14.5 million, even though these transfers were made out of Sentinel's futures customer-segregated account and into F.C. Stone's customer-segregated account, and even though they constituted trust funds under the Commodity Exchange Act and, as such, cannot be deemed property of the estate and subject to clawback. Second, the court allowed the clawback of the post-petition distribution, even though that distribution was expressly authorized by the bankruptcy court and, as such, is immune from clawback under Section 549A2B of the Bankruptcy Code. Third, the court erroneously allowed the clawback of the pre-petition distribution, even though that came squarely within the safe harbor of Section 546E, which immunizes pre-petition transfers that are made in connection with a securities contract. And finally, even if this court concludes that the trustee possessed valid clawback claims, nevertheless, F.C. Stone is not a proper defendant under Section 550 because it was neither the initial transferee nor the beneficiary of the transfers in question here.
I have had this sort of bottom line question in my head. So I'm just going to throw it out to begin with. Why should FCS do better than other trust claimant victims merely because by happenstance or otherwise, it was defrauded less than others? In other words, isn't it the whim of the defrauder that would determine who's getting the most assets?
Well, Your Honor, as this court stated in In re Kmart, even though bankruptcy is an equitable proceeding, that does not give the trial court free-floating discretion to redistribute rights in accordance with his views of what is just and fair, however lofty those views may be.
That's very well, counsel, as a general matter. But could you address more specifically the statutory rights and relative priorities under the Commodity Exchange Act and the Investment Advisors Act here?
Yes, Your Honor. The trustee is only allowed to claw back assets that constitute property of the estate. Under Butner v. United States, what is property of the estate is determined by applicable non-bankruptcy law, where federal interests are involved, is federal law. Here, because the funds involved were futures customer funds and the accounts were futures customer segregated accounts, it is the Commodity Exchange Act that covers the disposition of the funds and the rights of the parties.
What about the IAA?
Well, Your Honor, the nature of the funds F.C. Stone's rights to these funds is determined by the nature of the funds and the character of the trust that attaches to them, not the rights of third-party claimants. And the fact that there are another set of trust beneficiaries who gain less so far in the bankruptcy does not give them the right to invade the corpus of the Commodity Exchange Act Trust.
And would you agree, then, that argument depends upon your ability to trace?
No. Your Honor, here,
no.
What the parties are all in agreement on is that we have two trusts and two sets of trust beneficiaries. And as the district court itself said in describing what he was doing, he said, quote, "The principle that equality is equity remains the starting principle even when commingled funds are protected by competing trusts."
Do you know why Sentinel – did I interrupt you?
Just to finish my thought, if I may, Your Honor. Therefore, what we have are trust funds, regardless of whether they're within one trust or commingled trusts, under this court's decision in Mars Wind and the Begier versus IRS Supreme Court decision, trust funds can never be the debtor's property. And the trial court never explained how it is that the fact that these trust funds were being fought over by competing trust beneficiaries somehow transformed trust funds into the property of the estate.
I thought you alleged that they are traceable.
We believe they are, Your Honor.
Well, I thought you, when he asked you that, you said no.
No, what I was saying, Your Honor, is that the disposition of the case here, the reversal, does not depend on our ability to trace, even though we can. Rather, it depends on this court's decision in Mars Wind in Section 541 of the Bankruptcy Code. A trustee can only claw back assets that belonged to Sentinel at the time of the bankruptcy. As a matter of law, trust funds cannot be the property of the debtor or the debtor's estate. The court's fundamental error here was in concluding that because he had two sets of competing trust beneficiaries fighting over the same trust funds, that allowed him to sidestep the Commodity Exchange Act in Section 541 and instead apply equitable principles, but he never explained how that became the debtor's property.
I guess I don't understand how you think the district judge was sidestepping anything when what I see, for example, in the Commodity Futures Trading Commission amicus brief is a complete failure to recognize that we've got crooks who stole from everybody here by commingling funds. I frankly don't see, maybe I missed it in the briefs, with controlling precedent that deals with this kind of problem, two equivalent sets of statutory trusts.
Your Honor, whether the competing claimants are trust beneficiaries or just unsecured creditors, nothing gives them the right to invade the Commodity Exchange Act trust.
Why don't they have the same argument against you?
Well, Your Honor, if it were not for the fact that the debtor admitted that these were our funds and the NFA traced the funds prior to the bankruptcy and the fact that they were authorized for transfer to our FC Stone, we might have a different landscape.
You seem to be arguing that if the trustee and the district court are right, the CEA trust benefits are lost by the very wrongdoing they exist to protect against. But under your argument, it seems to me, and you dissuade if you can, the only people who are protected from the wrongdoer are the one group of customers who luckily happen to be the recipients of a transfer. Now, why shouldn't any of the other similarly situated customers be protected from the wrongdoing?
Well, Your Honor, we're not suggesting here that the other trust beneficiaries are not entitled to their own trust protection. But as their own forensic accountant admitted, they cannot trace any of these transferred assets to their accounts. That's actually in the trial record. So they are not arguing here that they can prove that any of these assets belong to them.
But did Ms. McCloskey's tracing exercise take into account the fraudulent nature of the record keeping?
Your Honor, even the debtor's even the trustee's counsel admitted that Sentinel kept, quote, extremely fine, entirely correct records of what was attributed to which client. The actual customer ledger was accurate, and the accuracy of that ledger was never challenged. Rather, the argument was that because the underlying fraud had not been disclosed, that meant that the account statements should not be considered as reliable simply because of the non-disclosure of the fraud. But nobody tested or challenged Ms. McCloskey's tracing conclusions.
In the trustee's brief, the trustee made several allegations about Sentinel's business practices that apparently Ms. McCloskey acknowledged. For example, Sentinel's customer ledgers didn't reflect the ownership of the vast majority of securities Sentinel held.
Your Honor, actually, What they were referring to were house securities such as repos and CDOs, not the corporate securities that were transferred here. And we agree with the Futures Industry Association here that the fact that there was other wrongdoing at Sentinel, the fact that government securities were repeatedly pledged to the Bank of New York, is not the relevant focal point. The question is whether these assets were in fact futures customer funds. And in paragraph 67 to 76 of the amended complaint of the trustee acknowledges that the securities here that were sold to Citadel, the proceeds of which were transferred, were in the segregated account until the end of June, went into a clearing account for 3 to 4 weeks, and then were transferred back and were in the customer segregated account for the 2 to 3 weeks leading up to the bankruptcy. That is not in dispute, and tracing is not required because the parties agree on that. And the argument here by the Seg 3s is that the overall fraud, even if it doesn't affect the ownership of these securities, somehow taints the entire process and creates an unfairness that gives them the rights to these assets. But if I may correct one other, what I believe is a misframing of the issue here, as we have pointed out, it is very clear that Judge Zagel thought that what he was doing was redistributing assets between two sets of trust beneficiaries. As we have pointed out, and as all the parties in this case agree, that is not what will happen. Actually, trust assets will be redistributed to the general unsecured creditor class, which means that at this stage, barring nothing happening in the Bank of New York decision, more than $500,000 will go to utility companies and landlords.
That was a 6% of the overall set of claims? That was part of the bankruptcy.
Something like that,
Your Honor.
Part
of the bankruptcy plan, right?
Correct. But here, this court...
So what's the big deal?
Well, Your Honor, there's no rule of law that allows even 6% of a trust corpus to be invaded.
Was there an objection to or an appeal from the bankruptcy plan?
No, Your Honor. But the, but the bankruptcy plan was not reserved the rights of the Seg 1 beneficiaries to pursue their trust claims. It did not do the same for the Seg 3 beneficiaries. But I think what is equally important and perhaps more important here is this court reversed the district court's related Bank of New York decision based upon evidence of possible complicity on the part of Boney. If, in fact, on remand, the district court avoids the Bank of New York's lien, then the Bank of New York will be placed in the pool of unsecured creditors. They will then comprise the largest single share of the unsecured creditor pool.
How much?
Approximately, if you net out all the claims against the recoveries, approximately 30% of the unsecured creditor pool.
If you were to put the two trusts, pardon me, I can't talk very well. If you were to put the two trusts in, I guess you'd say a challenge between two trusts, I go back to the traceability. If all of these assets that went to one or the other or didn't get them, is there a possibility of tracing the assets, assuming they're not the property of the trust, determining if they're sufficiently identifiable so that they could be attributable to one trust or the other?
Yes, Your Honor. 3 points on that. At page 487 of the trial transcript, the trustee's forensic accounting expert acknowledged that none of the assets that were transferred here could be traced to the Sec 3 accounts. Two, we presented overwhelming evidence of our ability to trace. And three, the district court, interestingly, did not address any of the undisputed tracing facts or conclusions presented by our forensic accounting expert. Rather, what the judge did, he decided as a matter of law that undivided interest in a pooled account cannot be traced, and as a matter of law, since cash is fungible, that cannot be traced, despite the opinions to the contrary of our expert. The reality, however, is that under the CFTC rules 1.20 to 1.33, those rules expressly provide that upon deposits by futures customers, they may be put into pooled accounts, and their interests will be represented by an undivided share of the pooled investments. So this is universal throughout the industry, as the Futures Industry Association points out.
So you have two categories, one traceable and the other pooled?
No, Your Honor, they are all traceable. My point is that Judge Zagel's conclusion that undivided interest in a pooled account is, as a matter of law, not traceable, not only is contrary to the opinion testimony at trial, but it is in direct contravention to the CFTC rules that expressly provide for this and expressly contrary to the universal custom of practice in the industry, as the Futures Industry Association points out in its amicus brief. This is the way business is done, and Futures Commission merchants have no problem tracing and accounting for their customers' interests.
Let me ask you a sort of bottom line, I don't know. Even if by operation of the CEA, customer funds are trust property and not property of the state, what happens when the CEA-regulated trust is completely eviscerated by the wrongdoing of a Futures Commission merchant? Can we still say there is a trust when the merchant hasn't followed any of the rules of the CEA that would normally make a trust?
Your Honor, I would submit to you that we can never accept a proposition that says that a statutory trust is destroyed by the very wrongdoing it is designed to protect against. If a statutory trust means anything, it must apply when there is attempted misappropriation on the part of the depository. And we would follow standard principles as articulated by the CFTC in ascertaining where the trust corpus is. If it has been moved out into a house account, it is still subject to the trust. Any other rule would essentially be saying crime pays, and it would incent the very misbehavior that the statute is trying to protect against.
By the way, as an aside, can you point to specific evidence that you would have offered in defense of the ordinary course of business defense, but were not, allowed to present?
Well, Your Honor, After the enactment of the original ordinary course of business provision in the Bankruptcy Code, an amendment was made in recent years to that also created an exception for transfers made according to ordinary business terms. And it was designed to protect transfers that are made that are legitimate as an entity slides into bankruptcy. Utility payments is one obvious example. These redemptions were made according to the standard terms under the investment agreement that our client had with Sentinel and fall within the ordinary business terms defense. I would also point out to the court that because no one was trying the count two claim, there was no evidence put in on the conduit issue, one way or the other.
The question was, what evidence were you not able to present that you would present if we remanded the case?
We would have presented testimony, Your Honor, that the terms under which we redeemed the pre-petition transfer were the standard terms under our investment agreement and inconsistent with customs and practices in the industry.
What's the specific evidence?
The investment agreement, Your Honor, I can't recall now which exhibit that was, but the investment agreement that was in evidence between Sentinel and FC Stone, which is consistent with industry practice.
What about, by the way, the agreement between Sentinel and FCS makes it a securities contract for purposes of the 546E defense?
Your Honor, under Section 741.7, where securities contracts are defined, an agreement is a securities contract if it provides for the purchase or sale of a security or a group of securities. The investment agreement gave authorization to Sentinel to purchase and sell securities on behalf of FC Stone, in return for which FC Stone received a direct interest in a portfolio of securities, and FC Stone had the right to withdraw to redeem its interests. Sentinel was required to follow instructions for redemptions, and that falls squarely within the definition of a securities contract under 741.7.
You want to save your time, I
yes,
know.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm sorry.
If I could, I wanted to just ask a couple of other questions. Mr. Bedell, if I got this right, that FC Stone is simply a test case for many others similarly situated?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. What are the overall stakes that we're talking about here for pre-petition and post-petition?
The principal amount of the post-petition, Your Honor, is $297 million. And the Your Honor, I'll be able to give you the principal amount of the pre-petition one in a moment.
And can you give us some sense of urgency with respect to resolving this matter, if there is any?
In terms of timing, Your Honor?
Yes.
All the related district court proceedings have been stayed pending the resolution of this case, and so there is no immediate urgency in that respect.
Or there's a lot.
Or there's a lot, but there's not an imminent trial.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Tiki.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Although the District Court's 54-page opinion is very detailed, the gist of this case boils down to the very questions that this Court asked at the start of its argument, which is, why was it appropriate for Sentinel Management to engage in massive preferencing of one group of creditors to the detriment of a similarly situated and similarly protected group of creditors? Contrary to F.C. Stone's argument, what the District Court judge did was not some unusual application of equitable principles that had never occurred before in the history of the bankruptcy court. The trustee sued on garden variety, preference and improper fraudulent transfer claims, and the district court, after considering lengthy evidentiary testimony, many, many trial exhibits, and following the letter of those statutes to their letter, concluded that improper post-petition transfers and preferential transfers had occurred.
I'm just going to say there's nothing that I saw that the trust itself had any knowledge of this or any participation in what would you call a preference, right? It was unilateral, something that Sentinel did.
Yes, but under the...
Because usually when you have that kind of a transaction, who's ever the preferred person that gets it may have something, some way of getting it ahead of time.
What happened here, though, was on August 13th, 4 days before the bankruptcy filing, Sentinel announced to the world publicly, it received great press, that it was not going to honor requests for customers' money back because it couldn't pay everybody in full. And then over the course of the next week, it made certain that it paid 71% to creditors like F.C. Stone and the other Seg 1 creditors. So I'd submit they did have knowledge.
Out of pure curiosity, do you happen to know why Sentinel was favoring SEG 1 funds over SEG 3 funds?
What happened when Sentinel made this announcement is that regulators descended on its doorsteps looking at what was happening because money was missing that should have been there. And I think the first regulators on the scene were the designated self-regulatory organization for its FCM status, which would have been the NFA, along with the CFTC. And I think that they pushed Sentinel to make these preferences to these entities, but irrespective of what happened.
Wait a minute. They say they pushed, the CFTC pushed to make,
certain that right. The customers that they were supposed to be protecting got paid ahead of whoever else might have a claim to those funds, including the Seg 3
customers.
Wasn't
Sentinel's discretion then what to do, was it?
Sentinel would have the discretion to do what it did, but what it did under the plain reading of Section 547B was to make preferential transfers. And so a trustee in bankruptcy can always claw those back. There's nothing wrong about making a preferential transfer per se.
It has to be property of the estate.
But it has to be property of the estate. And there, what Judge Zagel did was follow the case law that deals with this question of when property is property of the estate. F.C. Stone is not the first defendant to make the argument that what it received was property that should have been held in trust. And what Judge Zagel did was apply the legal analytical framework that cases that are cited in F.C. Stone's brief apply, cases that are cited in our brief apply, which is first look to see if a trust was created under some applicable law, and the court concluded that the Commodity Exchange Act would give them a right to create a trust, and then you look to see can you trace the property that was given to the trustee, here Sentinel, in back through wherever it went, however it was commingled, whatever its converted form was, back to the payments that the defendant, F.C. Stone, received. And it's in that second prong of the analysis where F.C. Stone failed to prove that it was entitled to assert a trust. And all of the arguments it makes...
F.C. Stone says, I think what they say is that the trust interest survives even if the mechanism fails.
right? Well, that's not what the Commodities Exchange Act says.
But how do you ignore the plain and simple fact that the CEA says the future commission merchant customer funds are always trust property?
That's not what it says. What it says is that the future commission merchant is supposed to treat that property as belonging to the customer. It also says that it's not to treat any other customer's property as belonging to any different customer, which suggests pretty clearly, I think, that the Commodity Exchange Act only allows a customer to assert a trust over its own property, not over the property of someone else. And by making the arguments that they make, that the Commodities Exchange Act should be honored, that somehow it's unfair to not impose a trust here, what they're really saying is we would like to grab the property of others. We would like a super priority claim without regard to our right of tracing so that we get paid first. The bankruptcy code does not create that right. There's no priority anywhere in the statute that gives them that right. There's nothing in the Commodities Exchange Act. As the district court correctly noted, there's nothing that says the Commodity Exchange Act customer comes first ahead of everyone else. And the findings of the court that there was a single undifferentiated pool of assets that consisted of Sentinel's property, SEG 3 customer's property, and SEG 1 customer's property like FC Stone's property, and that it was an undifferentiated mass, required that FC Stone trace, because unless it traced, it would necessarily be receiving someone else's property, and it didn't have any rights under the Commodity Exchange Act to that other property. They make an argument today, they made it in their briefs, that somehow because it's a statutory trust, that the law somehow gives them this super priority claim. What he's arguing off of is the Bergere versus Internal Revenue Service case, where the IRS gets that type of right because there is no trust race. The taxpayer never receives property from the government to hold in trust like Sentinel received from FC Stone. And so the Supreme Court, recognizing that and recognizing that you can't use typical trust principles, said for the IRS, you get a trust in an abstract dollar amount. It did not hold, and the case law does not support since Bergere that it applies to statutes like the Commodities Exchange Act or trusts like this where there is an actual trust race. It's been used to assist the government in collecting taxes.
What you seem to be saying then is that at some point the Sentinel took a property from the trust, the SEG 1, put it in, commingled it with others, and even though they say the same property identifiable was put back, you say it's sufficiently tainted where it cannot be labeled the same property?
They weren't able to trace that, Your Honor. They weren't able to show.
I've seen this. This is what confuses me, though, this traceable. They're supposed to be so particular in how they have to identify it with each transaction in order to have a segregated trust.
But in fact, we don't agree that they did that, and that's not what happened in Judge Zagel's decision, was that they could not trace. When he looked at that second question, could they trace? He first asked himself, are they entitled to the benefit of any tracing fictions, like the lowest intermediate balance rule or something of that nature? And he concluded that they were not because there were multiple victims of fraud, and if you applied tracing fictions for one, there wouldn't be enough money to go around. And that's been the established law under the Supreme Court's decision in Cunningham v. Brown, going back, 70 years. They dismissed that case because it's old, but Cunningham v. Brown was followed by this court just 2 years ago in the SEC versus wealth management case. It's a principle that is out there that tracing fictions, when parties make this trust argument, and the defendants in Cunningham were in the same position as FC Stone was today,
There was nothing legitimate about Cunningham. It was a total Ponzi scheme.
It was a Ponzi scheme. But ultimately, but this court applied Cunningham v. Brown in the wealth management case to a situation where the investment fund was making misrepresentations to the investors about how it was going to invest their retirement funds. It wasn't a Ponzi scheme. And we've cited, and Judge Zagel cites in his opinion, numerous other cases where Cunningham v. Brown has been applied outside of the Ponzi scheme circumstance because it's a rule that recognizes that tracing fictions are arbitrary. They don't really reflect true tracing. They just give the person a leg up to be able to go after commingled cash. And when the effect of that is that everyone traces and then no one can be paid, you can't apply those fictions and you have to require actual tracing. And when you look at that particular issue, their tracing expert, Ms. McCluskey, testified at page 1144 of the transcript that you could not correlate the purchase of any particular security with a deposit of any particular customer's money. She said you could never do that, not for F.C. Stone and not for anybody else. And so her definition of tracing was not looking at the dollar that F.C. Stone put in and tracing it through the commingled, undifferentiated pool of assets back out to F.C. Stone. Her definition of tracing was, let's look at the wrongdoer's arbitrary allocation of this on particular lists and say that's, as long as it was on this list when the music stopped, that's okay. But as Judge Zagel found, based on the record before him, Sentinel never purchased a particular security with a particular customer's dollars in mind. It always dumped all the cash into a commingled account. It then purchased securities not with regard to when it received deposits. It arbitrarily allocated it to different lists at different points in time. And as evidenced by that, the preferential transfer that they received, the cash, as the testimony of Mr. Logan, one of the Sentinel employees who testified, as the testimony of Mr. Feltman, our expert, was, that cash came from a Seg 3 cash deposit account at J.P. Morgan, was moved by Sentinel over to the Seg 1 cash deposit account, which had very little cash in it, and then all paid out to Seg 1 customers, including F.C. Stone, right before the bankruptcy. So if the lists mean anything, they show that they got Seg 3 cash. But in fact, what happened was this was, as Judge Zagel correctly found, an undifferentiated pool of securities that no one could trace against.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you about the question of whether the bankruptcy court authorized the post-petition distribution of, I guess, what, $279 million mm-hmm. or so. And I'd like you to try to do that without relying upon the post hoc explanation of the bankruptcy judge. In terms of the order that was issued, was it August 8th, if I got that right?
Yes.
Of 888. What language in that order put F.C. Stone and other Seg 1 customers on notice that they might be subject to a clawback?
The language in the order that says that its entry is without prejudice to causes of action by any party with respect to any claim under other applicable law.
I'm sorry. Wait a minute. That wasn't a direct quote, was it?
No, it's not a direct quote. It's,
okay.
it's taking out the intermediary language.
I want to work through this carefully.
If Your Honor looks at what they're saying any claim against any distributee, we would read, as Judge Squires did when he issued his decision in 2008, that there's really three things that are protected here.
Okay.
Claims with respect to the holdback dollars, then they say and or with respect to any claim for priority under Section 761 through 67 or other applicable law. This is a list of three things that are reserved.
Okay, but that's the right of each and every distributee. Right?
Again, it's claims against any distributee. And a
Wait a minute. Maybe I'm not. I'm looking at paragraph 3, right? Mm-hmm. Are we looking at the same thing?
Yes.
Okay, you're looking at the last sentence.
Yes,
okay.
The last sentence
okay.
is the operative sentence with respect to this issue.
Okay.
And a distributee is defined in paragraph 1 as any of the parties who are receiving
yeah.
money, the F.C. Stone.
I think what Judge Hamilton is trying to get to is what would the point of the bankruptcy judge's comfort order be if all it did was temporarily transfer funds to FCS only to have them clawed back years later. Is that what you're looking
Fair
at?
Fair enough.
So, yeah. Well, I think that's the...
The reason why Sentinel asked for the order, what it stated in the motion that it filed with the bankruptcy court that's on the docket, is that it had told Bank of New York to issue these wire transfers, that Bank of New York was refusing to do so, notwithstanding the fact that Sentinel was in bankruptcy and the automatic stay had gone into place, because two customers in two separate actions had obtained TROs asking that their money be frozen. And so Bank of New York was saying, there's these two TROs out there, and we're not going to listen to your instructions with regard to the bank account unless we're told by the bankruptcy court that the automatic stay applies to those orders in some way and that we're able to go forward. And that's why I think F.C. Stone's argument about why we shouldn't listen to what Judge Squire said really confuses, I think, what a court is supposed to do in the first instance, the trial court, in looking at what an order means when someone is bringing an order and requiring an interpretation versus what the standard of review is in this court. Because
I think what F.C. Stone is saying, I think, is that if the court avoids or subordinates the Bank of New York's lien, the Bank of New York may be treated as an unsecured creditor with that, you know, unbelievable over $300 million unsecured claim, even though the bank may have, you know, knowingly or recklessly participated in Sentinel's wrongdoing.
And, Your Honor, the relief we request against Bank of New York, which we don't have yet because it's on remand and there's matters for Judge Sagal to decide, the relief we request is not only that their liens be avoided as fraudulent transfers, but that their claim against the estate be subordinated to the claims of creditors like F.C. Stone and others. So if we prevail in that action, the parade of horribles that Mr. Bedell talks about would not really occur. And the other creditors are 0.3%. They're $3 million of a $1.3-plus billion pool. So they're a very, very small amount.
You know, but even if it's just, you know, 0.3%, is there a reason on principle that the funds that FCS returns shouldn't be shared pro rata with all unsecured creditors?
Yes, Your Honor, because they became property of the estate. And under Section 1129, which governed the confirmation of Sentinel's plan of reorganization, the priority scheme, once they became property of the estate, was that all general unsecured creditors would share in those funds. Once they lost their trust fund status, they were available for distribution in accordance with the bankruptcy code's priorities, which means that all of the unsecured creditors share. The money isn't going to go to Sentinel's insiders, the shareholders.
That's very troubling, though, to me, because both the IAA and CEA trust fund, or claimants in essence, do seem to have a legitimate claim to priority over other unsecured creditors, at least in the abstract. Would we have the power, if, as we sort through these issues, to order, in essence, that the Seg 1 and Seg 3 creditors have priority over other unsecured creditors?
That would require the court to modify the terms of the confirmation order. And remember, the amount of the unsecured creditors that have allowed claims with them is $3 million out of a $1.3 billion pool. But it would require this court to modify the terms of a confirmation order that F.C. Stone didn't appeal itself.
So you don't think we can do that?
But I really don't think that the court can, no.
But let's suppose the Bank of New York's lien is not subordinated. Then why would it be reasonable for folks like F.C. Stone and the hedge funds in Seg 3 to be put on the same par?
Because the inability to trace their money when it was combined also with Sentinel's assets into this undifferentiated pool causes it to lose its trust character. And there are cases, Griffin Trading Company, which was a commodities firm in this district, where the FCM customers, and that actually was a trading FCM governed by the special subpart rules that deal with some of the issues that Your Honor's talking about that don't apply in this case, where those creditors had to look to general assets because there wasn't funds held in segregation. They had been improperly transferred out of the estate. So it does happen in this area. It's happened in a case in this district where FCM customers have to share with general unsecured creditors when the trust pool is not there. For example, if Sentinel had taken every single dollar it had in trust for all of these creditors and just spent it in ways where there was nothing left, and all that was left was a car or a building or some other general asset, mm-hmm. under 1129, under the provisions that govern this bankruptcy case, they would be on a par with everyone else. And their inability to trace is the reason why they don't have a trust fund claim. They are just a general unsecured creditor. They were subject to these clawback provisions, and they were required to return the funds. Okay. I would like to, if it's okay with the court, address one argument that they have made for the first time in their reply brief, and that is on the safe harbor issue under 546E and whether the investment contract was a security. They rely on a case that came down after we filed our response, Peterson versus Summers Dublin, to make the point that this now is a security when they had never argued that before, because Peterson says that generally speaking, anything that's a security under the 33 or 34 Act is considered a security under the bankruptcy code. But that is really not accurate here. Here, the contract between Sentinel and F.C. Stone was an investment contract. And Section 10149A and B address specifically investment contracts. And what the provisions state are that if you have an investment contract that is required to be registered under the 33 Act and it's not exempt from registration only under Section 3B, that's a security. Any other type of security, and it's expressly stated in the second part that says what isn't a security under the bankruptcy code, the converse is stated, that if you're not required to be registered under the 33 Act or your exemption flows from a provision other than Section 3B, you're not a security. And Sentinel falls into that exclusion category. F.C. Stone didn't argue this before. It's not addressed in the judge's opinion below. We didn't really brief it, and they didn't present any proof about whether Sentinel was required to register under the 33 Act. However, you can look at the public records and you can see that Sentinel did not register under the 33 Act. Section 3B on its face is not the reason it didn't do so. Section 3B applies to public issuances of securities to a small number of holders under $5 million in value. Sentinel did not sell its investment services to the general public. You had to be an accredited investor. That's in the record. And it held over $1.3 billion of customer funds, so it wasn't a small issue. Although they didn't present any evidence on any of these points, it would appear on its face that Regulation D would have exempted, if you consider these investment contracts securities, and that wasn't briefed below, but if you consider them securities, Reg D would have exempted them from registration because it was a sale to a private sale to accredited investors. And so for that reason, it wasn't a security under the bankruptcy code, and so the safe harbor provision of 546E would not apply.
Along the lines of that, pre-petition distributions. Can you explain to me how it is that the district judge apparently ruled on this claim without it having been tried?
Yeah, how is that not a due process violation?
Well,
that's been in my head, too.
First, how did it happen, and then how could we possibly affirm that result?
Well, I think probably the reason why it happened is all of the issues that were in dispute in the preference claim were tried as part of the 549 claim. On the trustee's prima facie case for a preference, their dispute was whether the transfer was property of the estate. That's the exact same issue tried under 549. Their argument about the recoverability of the transfer under Section 550, that also was tried as part of the 549 claim. before trial, because this trial date, the motion to set the trial, happens many, many months before the trial actually occurs, where the parties say that we're just going to try the one claim, not the other. They file a motion for summary judgment, asking for summary judgment on the 546E issue, so that gets fully briefed. And on its face, and again, this wasn't briefed below, it's not in the briefs, but the standard for what is ordinary business terms is determined by this court's decision in Midway Airlines. We did not cite that, but that case does not hold that just because you pay under a contract, it's ordinary business terms. And you have to look at what was happening at Sentinel. It's not plausible that this was ordinary within the industry. It was everything, anything but ordinary. It was extraordinary. And so I think the judge just didn't see that as a serious defense to the claim, and they've never identified any evidence that they would, in response to the court's question in the briefing, they've never said, this is evidence that isn't in the record that we would point to that would require an additional hearing.
Okay. What I heard you just say is that there was overlap on some of the issues. The 546E safe harbor is not an overlap between what was tried and what was decided.
But they put that in issue, Your Honor, by the summary judgment motion. Well, and then the judge said, well, we'll just trial. He has a minute order where he says, I'm not going to decide it. We'll have the trial, and then I'll decide these things. So he kind of takes the summary judgment motions and sets them aside.
Where's that order?
I don't know the exact docket number. I could get that for the court. But there was an order where he says, I'm taking these under advisement. And I believe it's in the appendix of F.C. Stone.
Have anything else you want to say?
Unless the court has any questions, I see my time has expired.
Well, let me put it bluntly. How does the bankruptcy court authorize a distribution without authorizing a distribution?
I think the argument that the order should be read to do more than what it says. Because why would you do this if you weren't doing something isn't a reason to give the order more meaning. The court was very clear. If you look at what Judge Squire says, F.C. Stone was present at that hearing, as were most of the other recipients of the monies as a result of that order. And he says, I don't have the foggiest notion what's in this estate. There's no record in front of me. You're saying you want a comfort order. I'll sign this order because it lets anybody sue anybody for anything. And everybody, including F.C. Stone's counsel, who was there, were on notice that this wasn't giving them a safe harbor under 549. The judge was being told the world would come to an end if Bank of New York didn't listen to the instructions. Nobody was prepared to give him the evidence he needed to make the findings, and so he did the best he could with the language to make sure everyone's rights were protected. And when he later is asked to rule, to give an opinion about how to read that order, F.C. Stone files briefs making the same arguments they make here, and Judge Squires determines that paragraph 3 of his order means, as the trustee has advanced, as Judge Zagel found, and that ruling is entitled to deference because he was the court who entered that order.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Would you add 2 minutes, please, to Mr. Bedell's time, which give him an idea of how much time he has.
Thank you. Your Honor, I think it's critical at the outset that I address this authorization issue. At the time of the authorization, Your Honor, in a courtroom full of lawyers who represented the cream of the bankruptcy bar in Chicago, the court was addressed with what to do to the debtor's motion to distribute these assets. On no less than 7 occasions at that hearing, the debtor insisted that the assets...
Are you talking about the hearing that the comfort order came out of?
Yes, the authorizing order of August 20, 2007. And at that time, the debtor, on no less than 7 occasions, insisted that these assets were the property of the future's customers and needed to be distributed. Said 3 customers were present, and they noted that they had concern as to whether some of their assets might have found their way into the Citadel sale and were now part of the funds that were being asked for distribution. To address that concern, the bankruptcy court created a holdback of 5% or $15.6 million. And in that transcript, at pages appendix 91 and 92, it is made very clear that the purpose of the holdback is to address potential claims by Seg 3s that there were some of their assets in this overall fund. The court then authorized the distribution of the remaining $297 million. In doing so in his order on three separate points, he refers to the distribution as being authorized. He reserves two specific rights that are in the last sentence of paragraph 3. He states that he's reserving rights against the holdback for people to fight over whose assets those really are, and he's reserving claims for priority under the subchapters, under the commodity broker liquidation provisions of the code, because at that time there was concern over whether the case would be administered under that provision. It turns out that never happened, so that clause number one is just irrelevant. But more to the point, the only claims that were reserved under the commodity broker liquidation provisions were claims for priority. There's been a lot of confusion here in the use of that term. Priority is a defined term in the bankruptcy code under Section 507. It refers to the ranking of creditors' claims against existing property of the estate that is held by the debtor for payment of claims. It has nothing to do with whether the trustee might have a claim for clawback under Section 549 to recover assets that may or may not be property of the state in the first place. This case does not involve questions of priority. It involves whether the trustee has a valid claim for clawback to recover trust funds that under this court's decision in Mars Wynn cannot by law be property of the estate. And the trustee's reading leads to an absurd reading of this order. It asks the court to believe that the bankruptcy judge at the time created a holdback to address Seg 3 claims, then authorized the distribution, but at the same time reserved a right to claw back the distribution he just authorized while keeping the holdback to address those claims in the first place. It also leads to an absurd conclusion that somehow this catch-all phrase or other applicable law was some kind of an open-ended right allowing the trustee to pursue any claims he wished when standard canons of construction limit that clause to the preceding phrases. It also ignores the reality of the situation. Everybody was there before Judge Squires because he was told point blank by the regulators that if this money was not immediately released to the futures customers to meet their immediate margin obligations, as many as a dozen futures commission merchants might collapse with seriously detrimental, catastrophic effects to the futures markets. The idea that the parties present before Judge Squires and Judge Squires himself thought that they were releasing these assets only to delay the catastrophe beggars belief. And in addition, it ignores the provisions of the Commodity Exchange Act, which state that encumbered assets, assets against which there are competing claims, cannot be deposited into customer-segregated accounts. And you can find that in CFTC Rule 1.23 stated expressly, so that if, in fact, the trustees to be believed, then what we have is the bankruptcy court ordering the transfer of encumbered assets with competing claims to be deposited in an account into which they are not allowed. I finally would note that nobody in that hearing, and I've got the transcript right here, nobody before Judge Squires at that hearing even mentioned Section 549 or clawback claims, and it is nowhere mentioned in the order. The trustee's argument undermines the judicial interest in finality and ignores the reliance that all of the parties and the regulators placed upon this distribution being released to be deployed into the marketplace. I also need to address another point that was made about the McCloskey. Again, I wish to stress here that in the transcript at page 487, the trustee's own expert admitted that he could not trace any of the funds in question to the Seg 3 accounts. So despite what Ms. Stege said a few moments ago, the Seg 3s cannot and have not claimed that any assets of theirs are actually a part of the funds that were transferred. Their expert admitted that he couldn't trace any of those to their accounts. What we have is the simple assertion that because Sentinel used a single clearing account for the purchase and sale of both House, Seg 1, and Seg 3 assets, and in the court's view, that created an undifferentiated pool, therefore, one must conclude that the funds in question here, that were the securities that were sold to Citadel, somehow are also tainted and somehow cannot be traced. But as I stated earlier, if you look at the complaint at paragraphs 67 through 76, you will see that no tracing is necessary because the trustee himself tells us that the securities in question were in the Seg 1 account all the way up to July. They went out into the clearing account for 3 to 4 weeks and then right back to the proper segregated account. And I want to stress here the undisputed fact that $47 million of the Seg 1 securities that were sold to Citadel always remained in proper segregation. That is an uncontested fact. And that can be found at the appendix of page 1256. That fact has never been challenged, and the district court never explained how $47 million of securities that were always properly segregated and then sold to Citadel can somehow be viewed as the debtor's property. That flies in the face of every provision of the Commodity Exchange Act and the Bankruptcy Code, Section 541.
One quick question to follow up. How much money is at stake with the pre-petition transfer?
Your Honor, I am sorry. I will send that information to the court.
Could you please tell me now? Consult with whoever you need to consult with.
Thank you, Your Honor. $22 million total.
$22 million, thank you.
Yes, and $1.1 million to F.C. Stone. And I also want to stress one other thing here, that the...
It won't be very fair. Well, I'll let you make your last point, but...
I am sorry. No.
But, all right, make that last point. Maybe it'll help us.
Well, there is some confusion here about which is the relevant transaction. It is true that Ms. McCloskey acknowledged that, as the record makes clear at the trial, Sentinel was in a buy-and-hold strategy. Many of these securities that were sold to Citadel were bought 6 years earlier. She acknowledged that nobody could go back that far and determine exactly which funds were used to buy those initial securities. But she demonstrated at trial that the relevant transaction is when the securities were purchased by F.C. Stone or its customers, at which time, when they deposited cash, securities in an equivalent amount were allocated to or credited to its account, and only then was the cash removed. That is the relevant transaction, and placing the burden on an entity such as F.C. Stone to go back many years earlier and attempt to trace the history of securities back a decade or more is simply unrealistic, and the law does not require that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Right. Well, thank you. One and all. And the case will be taken under advisement.